When you talk like that, I'm tempted to ring for Nanny and have you put to bed with no supper.
That was the Dowager Countess of Grantham, and this is Underscore, a podcast of music and story.
Today is the first of a two-episode week, and we are honored to be joined by the award-winning composer, John Lunn.
Welcome back to Underscore, a podcast of music and story. I am Marty Brueggemann. With me, as always, is my brother, Will.
On today's very special episode, we have a conversation with the Emmy Award-winning composer, John Lunn.
You know John from his many years of acclaimed work in film and television, most notably composing the worldwide phenomenon series Downton Abbey, for which he won two Primetime Emmy Awards.
His title theme from Downton is now recognized the world over and is included among many best of all time lists of television themes.
Both a classically trained composer and innovative producer, John brings a unique blend of musical depth and contemporary daring to his work in TV and film.
In addition to his beloved work on Downton, he's also known for his scores to several BBC adaptations of Charles Dickens' classics, including Little Dorrit, which was nominated for both BAFTA and Emmy Awards, and The Mystery of Edwin Drood, which was nominated for an Ivor Novello Award in 2013.
Also in 2013, John composed the score to The White Queen, based on the series of books by Philippa Gregory, and this year has composed the score to its sequel series, The White Princess, airing now in the U.S. Sunday evenings on Stars.
In addition to his great work as a composer, John is a truly sweet person who has much to say on music and its storytelling power.
We are now so pleased to be joined by Mr. John Lunn himself here on Underscore. John, thanks so much for coming on the show. Both Will and I are such fans and admirers of your work, and it's just a real treat to get to chat today.
Oh, thank you, both of you. I know it's lovely to meet you both. I'm really pleased, you know, to be able to talk to everybody from wintry London, actually, in April.
Well, thanks to the magic of the internet, we can all have this conversation. But I kind of want to get into things musically, starting with something a bit more recent. You very recently composed the score to The White Princess, which has now premiered on both sides of the Atlantic. It's a miniseries and essentially a sequel to a previous project that you've worked on, The White Queen. What can you tell us about your work on the new show and perhaps how the scores for Princess and Queen relate to one another?
Well, I was really pleased with what I'd done on The White Queen, and there was kind of talk of a sequel, and then it disappeared a bit, and then but then Stars kind of came back in again, and I think it did really well, The White Queen. It didn't do so well here for some reason.
Oh, interesting.
Not sure why. And so when they came to The White Princess, which, you know, okay, it's a different name, but it's based on the same books.
Sure.
And I think Stars were kind of keen to keep the branding kind of quite similar. So the fact that there was a 2 or even 3 years between each series, it meant that a lot of the actors weren't going to be the same. They were going to have to change. And of course, one of the great things you can, you know, to kind of keep some kind of sense of, you know, of unity is, you know, is to use the same music.
Sure.
Or the same style of music. So, in fact, they approached me very early on, and I really wanted to do it. You know, I'd been nominated for an Emmy for it.
Right.
And I was really happy with it. I was really happy to explore that material. Although, I mean, I think it was 10. I think the first series was like 10 episodes. This one's only 8.
Okay.
But it was a bit of a no-brainer to kind of take it on. And so we kept the same title, mm-hmm. music, although actually we've extended it. Well, Stars extended the sort of titles, and so we've re-recorded the title sequence.
Oh.
And we've kept, you know, of course, the same story, you know, about the White Queen was kind of this conflict between two basic, you know, English families, the Tudors and the Yorks, and that kind of carries on all the way through The White Princess as well, with the one exception is that somehow the two of them have been married together, you know, Henry the Seventh and Elizabeth of York are now joined together. So that's the kind of the House of Tudor and the House of York. So I had all these themes in The White Queen that were to do either the Yorks or the Tudors. And now they're kind of combined. I had to sort of find a way of kind of, you know, sort of combining them. So there's probably about 50% of the themes from The White Queen have moved over into The White Princess, and then about another 50% of it is new.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that seems like a kind of a wonderful opportunity to revisit some of your scores and maybe find interesting ways for some of those motives to kind of interact.
Well, that's why I really like doing this, you know, long format TV. You know, it gives you this, you know, opportunity to develop your material and see what you can, how far it can go. And, you know, I didn't really realize at the time when I first started doing these long running TV shows that was how it was going to pan out. But so it kind of took me by surprise, but that's kind of why I've, you know, stuck with it.
Well, that's wonderful. Really, there is some marvelous music in The White Queen, particularly like the title theme, and excited that that's going to get a second life in the new miniseries. And also some of the really sort of intimate pieces, like I believe it's labeled Coronation on the soundtrack.
Yeah.
Some just lovely examples of music that I think is very contemporary, in some ways minimal, but it's that sort of direct writing that is very tuneful and emotional and memorable, which I think encapsulates so much of your voice.
Yeah, I mean, you know, simplicity is kind of, you know, is everything, you know, I think, especially in, you know, music to film. I mean, the more, you know, I try and have very few elements going on. I try and make each element, you know, really be, you know, actually stand for something. I don't have, you know, templates of hundreds of different sounds going on. I try and keep it, you know, much simpler. You know, I never studied how to write for film.
Sure.
There was no such thing as a course in film music, you know, in my day. You know, you just kind of, you know, sort of fell into it. So even now, despite everything I've done, it's all instinct.
Oh, that's wonderful. Gosh. Well, you know, from our perspective, there's been a real positive trend of British series getting more exposure here in the U.S. Stars, yeah, for instance, with that series. Our mother, in fact, is a real admirer of Grantchester, which has gotten a little bit of exposure over here. And it's another series for which you composed the score. And once again, really lovely music. How would you describe your approach to Grantchester specifically, capturing that sort of aesthetic and the tone of that show?
Yeah, that was quite tricky. In fact, it's sort of changed over the series, but I've just finished the third series, which hasn't gone to
many.
It's just started here in Britain. It was quite difficult because it was quite humorous, you know, at times. There was always this kind of murder mystery element to it, and then there's a much longer arc, a love story to do with all the sort of main characters. And I think what I ended up with was, you know, I've got to pay attention to the story of the murder mystery. But actually, I'm much more interested in the development of the characters and their, you know, sort of love story. And in fact, if you notice in the way that it's written, it's very cleverly written, is that even the murder mystery kind of element to each episode has some bearing on the lives of the sort of main characters and how they're all interacting with each other. So I sort of developed this, what I call, it's sort of got a slightly ethereal quality, you know, because, you know, he's a priest.
Religious person, yeah.
So I sort of developed this sort of idea that even when he was solving the murder mystery, that he was being guided by, you know, some sort of higher being in the ether.
Oh, that's lovely. Sure.
God sort of figure was kind of helping. And So I did try. There's a very sort of ethereal quality to the music. There are times where I've had to move away from that, but that was the kind of concept behind that.
I think ethereal is a perfect tone for it, and I think Grantchester, like Downton, really touches on some of your beautiful harmonic language, particularly, I mean, all over the place in Downton and in Grantchester, the use of these beautiful dense seventh and ninth chords, often set in the strings. It's so sumptuous, but like Marty said before, also very contemporary. It's almost like a chord language that would also be at home in the pop world, but tastefully set for orchestra. So is that extended harmony something that you've always been drawn towards just as a musician and composer?
You know, it kind of sort of developed. You know, I studied music at university and I was, you know, at one point I really wanted to be an avant-garde, you know, classical composer.
Oh, sure.
But mm-hmm. when I was growing up, my father had been a saxophone player in a jazz band. There was lots of jazz in the house, you know. And then when I finished university, I actually went into pop music. I got a publishing contract to write
really?
Song. Yeah, it never really worked out. My heart wasn't really in it. I was much more interested in things like Talking Heads. And
oh, sure.
Although I was a massive Steely Dan fan.
Sure.
So I've always been interested in both worlds, both classical, pop, jazz, you know, you name it. Each one of those genres I'm quite happy in, you know, and pop music, you know, I love Sly and the Family Stone,
things like that.
So that kind of harmony, or one of the things about the harmony was that was one of the main things we did at university, which I'll never forget, was we had to do fugues in the style of Bach. We had to do two a week, you know, for like 2 or 3 years. And we used to all complain about it, but my God, you know, it come out of it, you know, you understand how harmony works, you know, when you do Bach fugues. So harmony is really my thing, actually. And in fact, that's how I define a project that I'm working on, is not so much the sound world, but the harmony. Mm. You know, what can I do with the harmony? Can I have, you know, minor sevenths? Can I have major sevenths here? Does it have to be much starker? You know, the White Princess is, in a way, actually, the White Princess is kind of gets a bit more eloquent, but
it has a lot of the sort of open fifth kind of world.
Yeah, there's a lot of open fifths, a lot of open fourths, you know, but none of them, neither, you know, the White Princess, Grantchester, or Downton, they don't sound like their period.
Right.
Right.
That's not my job. It's not my job to conjure up the period that I'm writing in. You know, my job is to tell the story,
right,
and to get inside the actors' heads and describe what's going on inside there.
I think that's such a brilliant choice, because what I so love about your music is that even though it's not directly imitating the period music, there's this elegance and depth of emotion that at the same time feels fitting for a period piece. There's an element of, like, the way that you restrain all that harmony, part of it might be just attributed to the orchestra itself as an entity being this kind of timeless element of musical storytelling, but your music has this sophistication. There's never any kind of cognitive dissonance, I feel, from hearing music that isn't, you know, evoking a specific period.
Yeah. I mean, it is quite difficult. I mean, sometimes people will come and say, like when I did Downton, everybody said, okay, we want a modern score. We don't want a period score. But they have no idea what they mean when they say that.
That's so true.
Right, do they want like synthesizers and everything?
Yeah, but you have to take that into account. I knew when they said that, I knew what they meant. So, I mean, if you really analyze the chord structure to the Downton Abbey theme, you know, it's much more like a Coldplay song.
Oh, that's such...
Right.
But it's got this veneer of Elgar or Vaughan Williams. But actually, you know, it's A minor, F major, A minor, F major.
Right.
And then a dominant seventh in G, third inversion. And then a suspended chord. And then C major seven. I mean, that's, you know, it could easily be, you know, a Coldplay song.
Well, I think that the string counter melody really adds to the lusciousness. The that carries you away into another world.
I mean, that made it in a way. It's so simple, but so it's just one of those things. You know, I can't really explain it. It just happened. You know, I was sitting. I was playing at the piano. I just knew. I knew it as soon as I played it. I knew it. I knew that was it.
I suppose really like most Americans, that's really where we were first exposed to your music and your name with that main title. From what we understand, that was really developed by scoring the opening scene to the first episode with this locomotive speeding through, and I believe Mr. Bates is on the locomotive.
Bates is looking out of the window. You know, we don't know if he is, a lonely man. So you get this, dan, 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 sing kind of single note piano tune picked out. You know, it's a kind of solitary sort of feel. Meanwhile, the train is going da, 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 da,
right.
And then, you cut to the telegram and you get that string tune you were talking about. Da, 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 da. And that telegram is carrying the information that...
Oh, the Titanic.
The Titanic.
To the Downton has been drowned on the Titanic. We don't know any of this at all. But you can tell by the way that the music imbues in the scene, that it's obviously important and we're going to, find out. Eventually, and then finally we arrive at a picture of Highclere Castle itself, well, Downton Abbey,
right?
And that's when the harmony sort of broadens out and it becomes kind of quite sort of pompous. But that was the very first scene in the show, and it just worked so well.
Wow.
Because there was no title. That's right, there was no title sequence in the very first episode. It just started straight off with our train.
It's amazing hearing stories like that because, famously, Bernard Herrmann, the main titles for North by Northwest were not originally intended as the main titles. And I've even heard that Bear McCreary, his theme to The Walking Dead, originally was just a piece of score from the pilot episode. Yet I think all those examples, especially with Downton, they seem so perfectly fit to setting the tone for the experience. It's so magical that it really just came from a genuine your response to the images in that first episode.
Well, I say that all the time. People, when as soon as I start a job, I say, what's the title music going to be? And I say, wait, let me get to the end of the first episode, maybe even get to the end of the second episode. I'll have it by then. I'll know there'll be a feeling or a theme or a thing that just works and summarizes, what you're about to see. And I don't like this idea of a theme tune that's not hasn't really come out of, the underscore
sure
to the film. I mean, there are obvious, exceptions. I think the Scandinavian, The Bridge.
Oh, I don't think I do, no.
I mean, they use a song. And it is fantastic, and it really does sell. And then you never hear it out throughout the rest of the show. So I'm not saying, it's a hard and fast rule, but that's the way I like to work. I like to, at least get to the end of the episode, see what material we've got, and then, And that's what happened with The White Queen, was that title music, I think, I didn't get until, I was about three quarters of the way through the first episode.
Oh, wow.
It just became obvious what it needed to be.
But then it's terrific because it feels so deeply rooted in the fabric of the score. I mean, I suppose it's like good writing, whether, teleplay or screenwriting or novels, when you can inform earlier portions of the story and those character reveals with what you've learned in the process of writing the whole thing. There's so much more depth to that experience, I think, for us as an audience.
Well, if you look at Downton, that theme you could split into basically four elements. There's that da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da
train
thing. There's the solo piano tune, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. There's a rising string, da-da-da-da-da-da. And then there's a pompous bit where the chords, So that's is that five?
I think that's four.
Okay, so all four of those elements in one form or another persisted throughout the entire series and was the basis for virtually not everything, but everything hung on that.
Wow.
It's really so wonderful, though, because it has every emotional musical element you would need. You have a motor with the sort of ostinato. You have almost this mechanical theme identifier with the repeated note idea. You have this sumptuous lyrical counter melody. And then that B section with those really beautiful, you describe them as pompous chords, but that really fulfills some of the more advanced harmony we were talking about before. And you've so brilliantly used that throughout the series in a multitude of presentations.
it's every job I work on, I always try and get as much time as possible for the first episode. You know, after that, I don't really care. You know, you need to get off to a really good start. For each new project I work on, I need at least 5 or 6 weeks just to do the first episode, because sure. I need to be in a good shape. You know, if you can get that first episode and the material you've got and you're working with and you're happy with, then the rest of it's all going to fall into place.
Do you ever find yourself reading scripts, or do you wait to see the kind of finished product?
You know, I read the script. I quite like reading the scripts, but I still can't tell really what kind of music is going to work. It's all about the images. And I do find it difficult to work without the images. If I work on my own, you know, just sitting at the piano with nothing in front of me, I end up making the music too complex. You know, I need to look at it. I need to look at the screen and, you know, and see what's going on, because it's all about the timing. It's all about the movement. It's all about the way the edits are cut together, you know, and the speed of the edits. All that, for me, anyway, you have to do it to the actual images themselves.
That makes so much sense. And I think really speaks to your voice as a composer, where your music is usually so married to the images and really temporally married to the edit. One question, I'm trying to remember if in that first episode of Downton, did you also have that had that fragment popped up yet? Which I know sometimes kind of takes us out of the title sequence.
So that, you know, the first scene we were talking about with the train and Bates looking out the window and the telegram. Right. Well, the very, very next scene was the house being kind of woken up in the morning by the servants.
Sure. Opening the windows and that sort of thing.
Opening the windows, kind of, you know, getting the fires going. And actually, I realized very quickly that the same music worked, because it was like a well-oiled machine. You know, it was like the train. You know, the servants were like the train. And so the same music actually worked, that same bustle and energy, you know, kind of, you know, transferred itself from the train to the servants. And obviously I had to do something slightly different. So that's where that da-da-da-da-da kind of, you know, cropped up.
Oh, that's so lovely.
Interestingly, the first 10 minutes of Downton, there's hardly any dialogue.
Ah, that's right.
Virtually no dialogue. It's all music.
Wow.
There's a few sort of hellos. There's a bit where the woman opens a telegram and she goes, "Oh my God," and you don't know, that doesn't mean anything. You meet everybody. Well, not everybody, actually. You meet Lady Mary, I think, is the only one of the actual house family.
She sort of looks out the window.
But you meet her, and it's 10 minutes of music, but it's one of the clearest episodes of drama I've seen. It was so brilliantly directed. Because you had a credible eye, you knew who these people were and what their place was within that world. I mean, it was brilliant. Right. It was a great vehicle, you know, for music.
Well, there really is so much memorable music throughout Downton Abbey, much of it lyrical and beautiful, but we have a particular soft spot also for some of the more comedic cues, such as like the escapades on the soundtrack collection. Writing comedic underscore is such a mysterious and challenging art, but yours seem to play both the straight man while still being a bit cheeky. As composers ourselves, we're just sort of curious how you approach these types of comedy cues.
Well, to be honest, what happened was we sort of fell into the comic aspect of Downton by accident, because I felt quite strongly that I shouldn't be involved in the comic nature of it, you know, because I always worry about music that you can, you know, you can end up lampooning the whole thing and everybody, people don't take it seriously.
And Maggie Smith certainly doesn't need any help with her comedy.
No, exactly. No, I mean, her timing is just so brilliant. So what happened was, I think it was in either episode one or episode two, there was a scene in the kitchen that was quite funny, what was happening, but they had a problem with the sound. There was some sort of sound that was going on that they couldn't get rid of. And so they thought, well, why don't we put some music going on there as well? Maybe that'll kind of mask, you know, and then so I did this kind of pizzicato string kind of, you know, thing, and everybody went, oh, that really, you know, that really works. And from there on, you know, we just kind of, we got into that, and then I got quite into the, you know, the comic part of it. I did find it quite hard, you know, music and comedy, you know, it can be quite tricky at times.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially to maintain that balance of drama and comedy at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, there were times when I did have to, you know, move between the two, and it really was quite tricky at times.
Oh, gosh, I imagine. You know, actually, that reminds me of another aspect of the Downton score that I find kind of fascinating, which it seems like at a certain point, and I guess I'm not sure how early on this was the case, you had really sort of a battery of ideas and little motifs and cues that seemed like they could almost in a modular way kind of operate in scenes. I mean, certainly coming out of the main title, it's always seamless every single episode, but we're almost always going into a different piece of music. But it's not only the main title, really throughout most of the scene transitions in the show, if there is underscore happening, there seems to be really seamless transitions. Just logistically, how is some of that achieved? It seems like you must have had a clear understanding of sort of the appropriate tempos for some of those things.
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, I don't think we ever use the same cue twice in the whole series.
Oh, that's terrific.
Yeah, everything was always redone. When they were editing, they would use my, you know, music from previous series to kind of help them sort of edit it, but it would never quite work. You know, the music is really carefully choreographed underneath the dialogue, and it's a very malleable style of music that was really, you know, essential. So it can move very quickly from one thing to another. You know, it can be very fast, it can be very funny, it can be very moving. You had to be able to move between all those things, you know, very quickly. And that's also partly down to the harmony as well, you know, understanding how the harmony works within it. And the themes were less about characters themselves. They were more about the relationships between people.
Sure.
More than anything else. So the music also worked as a sort of shorthand. It was almost, you know, describe a scene before you actually kind of got there. Because if you've got people watching, you know, a TV series, and they might have missed a previous episode, they don't quite know what's going on between certain characters. I felt my job was to kind of explain what the feeling was between them so that people could then take in, you know, the information. So the music was working like a sort of emotional shorthand.
Sure.
Right.
If that makes any sense.
Absolutely.
And it's really the only element in the production that has really any sort of taste of the 21st century. And sure. So in some ways, I don't know if it's subconscious, but the music feels so personal, I think, as we're viewing the show. It does feel like it's really in our minds, maybe even more than underscore typically is, just because it feels like it bridges the gap of that sort of the history between the characters and
Yeah, film. What's really interesting about doing these talks is that it forces you to think about what you're actually doing. You know, I mean, most of it is, you know, I promise you, is totally instinctual. Now that I look back on it, you know, I'm able to say, well, actually, what your music's working as a kind of shorthand. In a way, I wasn't really thinking about that at the time. It just became obvious, you know, through having conversations with people like you about it.
Well, I'm curious how you developed some of these instincts, because you talked before, and I'm sure that it is true that it is very natural for you to have a certain emotional response when watching a series of images, or whether it's a film or television episode. But how did you start to develop these instincts, and what are some of the influences that you draw upon, whether it's other composers or elements of storytelling that have impacted the way in which you naturally choose to approach score?
Oh, you know, it's, I think, you know, when I was a kid growing up as a family, we did watch a lot of great movies. We watched a lot of Westerns for some reason.
Oh, sure.
And I did find myself, you know, being sort of moved watching a film and then, you know, not quite understanding why I was so moved. Oh, I remember my grandfather took me, when I was the age of 12, took me kicking and screaming to see The Sound of Music, which I thought was going to be a girly sort of movie. And I think I have to go and see The Guns of Navarone or something like
right,
that.
Right, right.
And I was in floods of tears at the end of The Sound of Music. I just thought, oh my God, that's so powerful. You know, that combination of that song and the meat in the film. And I thought, oh, wow, you know, that you can... And I've sort of kept that with me. And I, you know, I have been fascinated by film. You know, I've watched a lot of it. Funnily enough, I don't watch a lot of it now. I don't.
Sure.
I mean, it's partly because I've been so busy. I mean, it's terrible. I must watch more films. It's not that I don't like watching them, but I've sort of kind of got out of that habit. But, you know, I did watch a lot of movies, you know, when I was in my teens and in my 20s. And, you know, I could see, you know, something like Chinatown, for instance, I think is a term. And how that music was sort of used to just create a world. I mean, Chinatown's, you know, 30% of that film is the music.
Right. That's the real atmosphere. Goldsmith's score and that trumpet and everything.
Yeah, that trumpet. And it sounded really modern as well. You know, so it's something I've always, you know, been interested in. And I get involved in it myself. If I'm expecting people to cry at a particular scene, if at some point when I'm working on it, and that hasn't happened to me, then I know I haven't done my job. You know, obviously I'm not going to cry every single time because, you know, there are some technical aspects of going over and over and over something, you know, that can eventually get boring, but you're trying to get it right. But at some point there will be a process where I've gone, oh, yeah, that's it. You know, and I've kind of been, you know, emotionally drained myself. So I do get into it. You know, it's not, I've never been one of these people that switches the dialogue off and tries to write proper music, you know, and then plant it over a film. I'm not into that at all. It's got to work together. That's the whole point, you know. And actually, some directors I speak to slightly freak out when I say this to them, but when I'm really working on a scene and the scene starts to take on a meaning that wasn't there before, I know I'm onto something. You know, it's changed my feeling. And that's the instinct thing.
Right.
Right.
He's a composer. I mean, for me, basically I improvise, but I've got the ability to be able to sort of play something and then recognize when I've got the germ of an idea.
Right.
I think that's what makes all composers.
I think that's an element that, in my opinion, is sometimes missing today in some films and television, where it seems that in certain cases, the music is almost doing as little as possible to not change the emotional tone at all. And what I do miss in many cases is the fact that music really has the ability to elevate and completely change the emotional context. And I think that's a good thing. I know, as you mentioned, that oftentimes some directors and producers might be afraid of that. But when you think of successful collaborations like, say, John Williams and Steven Spielberg, a big part of their success has to do with the freedom that Mr. Spielberg has given John Williams to allow him to indulge and really enhance the emotions of the film.
I know. I completely agree with that. Sometimes, when I'm sitting down with a director to work out what we're going to do with the music, I always say to them, I said, well, what are we not seeing? What do you want the music to do in this scene that's not on the screen already?
Right.
Because that's the point of it. You know, I've got to be doing something more than you're actually seeing. There's no point in me just telling you, you know, they're in love. There's got to be something like, he's a bit more in love with her, or I've got to put something into the scene that's in people's heads in a way, not totally what you're seeing.
That really sort of pinpoints what's so special, I think, about your compositional voice and your scores is they really do provide that. We've talked about it before on the show in great scores where it's almost emotional backstory in some cases, or it's information that's outside of the frame of the film. And I have to imagine that a lot of the success for Downton, and it was sounds like kind of a runaway surprise success, even for all of you involved. I have to believe the score, you know, has a large responsibility for that, not just the memorable theme, but really emotionally how it works as a part of the storytelling.
I mean, I think, you know, still trying to be modest, yeah, I think it's been generally recognized that the music, you know, did play a massive part in Downton. And actually, one of the reasons why, I think, was that there was really only two of us involved in doing the music. It was myself. Well, obviously, I wrote it, but, you know, I didn't really deal with that many directors. The directors I never even met.
Oh, wow.
It was myself and Gareth Neame, who is, well, we've become very close friends over the years.
Well, and he was the one who sort of encouraged Julian to write the project. Is that right?
Yeah, it was, the whole thing was his concept. Well, it grew out of Gosford Park,
right,
which of course was Julian's. But then basically, I mean, Julian's great about, you know, he's quite, actually quite knowledgeable about music, but he didn't really get involved in the music for the show. It was really just me and Gareth Neame. And in many ways, that really helped it. Mm-hmm. There weren't hundreds of voices all going, well, we think the music should be like this, we think the music should be like that. There was very little of that. It was basically the two of us. And the producer, Liz Truebridge, was also very helpful, you know, certainly in the first episode. Because there wasn't a lot of other people involved, it meant we really were on top of it. We knew exactly what we were doing. I mean, I would do the scene, I would send it to him, he would come give me feedback. And we weren't then sending it out for loads of people to have feedback on it either.
Sure.
It was just him and I. You know, and quite often the directors never had a say, you know, what the music was going to be. I mean, partly because, you know, a director would come in, want to make his mark on a particular episode. And actually, you know, that's the last thing you want to do with the music, you know, because you want, right, you want kind of sense of continuity.
Right.
And in fact, as Gareth Neame said to me at one point, I think by the time we got to series three, why we get the directors involved? You know how the music works in the series much more than they do. You know, what right, it's to be. That's kind of right, what happened, really.
Well, I imagine that's a big difference between television and film, because there is this importance of consistency, and even though directors may change, the music needs to maintain a similarity throughout the series. How is that different from working with films where sometimes you almost need to more acquiesce to a specific director's demands?
Yeah, I mean, I don't mind, you know, either way. I think the difference is, well, there isn't really any difference, except in film you do generally work with a director. On long-running TV series, you do have this either kind of showrunner or an executive producer, and the directors kind of come and go. In a film, you're usually working with a director. And, you know, I don't mind who I work with, you know, whether it's the showrunner or whether it's the director. What I don't want is lots of competing voices. Right. You know, I mean, that was one of the great things about The White Princess. Stars were incredibly supportive. They liked the music of The White Queen. So there was very little, yes, I got notes back from them, but they would seem to be very happy for me to kind of, you know, do it. You know, I didn't have to change very much. And, you know, in a film, you know, it's much the same thing. You know, as long as I've got somebody I trust and who knows, you know, what they want, I'm quite happy to accept criticism. You know, people don't like what I do. You know, I'm very happy to go off and try something else. You know, I'm not foolproof. What I don't like, you know, is that, you know, well, you know, well, actually, we quite like this, a bit of that, a bit of that. And I've heard some horror stories about some films where they're changing like every second note and stuff like that.
Oh, gosh.
I just couldn't get into that at all.
And it gets us so far away from that experience you were talking about of sitting alone, maybe with your keyboard, watching the footage, instinctively responding to the material. When it becomes a, you know, compromise by a committee, it almost breaks that connection, that pure
you need to have
connection.
A respect for the intuition of the composer. Like you said, John, that's a huge part of not only your process, but I think some of the best composers who've ever scored for film, you kind of have to trust their intuition at a certain level. And even if things have to change, a respect of that initial response is, I think, so important.
Yeah. If you get down to the level of, well, I don't particularly like that bar of music or a couple of seconds.
Sure.
You know what yourselves, what music's like, you know, you can't suddenly take out a bar and put in someone else. You know, you might as well go back to square one and start again because of that right. single bar. Because if you start changing that bit, music's a bit like a sentence. You know, you miss out a couple of important words in the middle, the whole sentence is destroyed. Or, you know, if you don't start at the beginning, you know, it's grammar.
Right, right. Staying for a moment in the sort of film side of things, in 2014, you composed the score to Electricity.
Yeah.
Wonderful British film. We're particularly taken with the sort of processed electronic elements in the score yeah. and how truly melodic they are throughout. Actually, for me, sort of surprisingly melodic for that kind of production approach. What could you say about composing for non-traditional sort of sound designed instruments?
Well, actually, if I'm left to my own devices, I'm really into electronic music. I've got quite a studio, not this one, but another one, where, you know, I've got a lot of synthesizers and I've got into this thing called modular synthesis as well.
Oh, wow. That's really exciting.
And I'm really into all that kind of thing. So when I was offered Electricity, I kind of jumped at the chance because it was very different from Downton, and B, I just, from the subject material, which it was about a girl who had epilepsy, I knew that it was going to be very internal sort of music, and I had to get inside her head in a way. So for a film, it was very director-led. It was basically mm-hmm. me and the director. I can't remember how it happened, but we decided to set ourselves a limit in that the music, although it was electronic, it was going to be all analog. We weren't going to use any digital elements. So there's no sample libraries. There was a real electric piano, a Roland Space Echo. Mm-hmm. Oh, there was an Oberheim Vorvoice. That's just a brilliant thing from the 70s that I bought, you know, secondhand. And we decided, you know, to kind of stick to those elements. Actually, I find that quite liberating, you know, not using any sample libraries whatsoever. No.
Yeah.
Obviously, it was digitized in the end because we had to use Pro Tools to actually, you know, record the final thing. Mm-hmm. But all the sound world was created through using, you know, real instruments. And I played absolutely everything.
Wow. So I imagine you weren't sort of mocking things up, but you were actually kind of working and writing with the synths, and then that stuff survived.
Yeah, no, there was no mocking up at all because the mocking up was it.
Right.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, well, it was quite exciting. And funnily enough, I did discover that by abandoning sample libraries, I found myself actually, I could write quite a lot simpler because the sound of those, like the sound of an electric piano going through, you know, a Roland Space Echo, was you could do a lot with just that, just those two elements. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the film's got to be right for that kind of sound world, but it enabled me to be, you know, which is the thing I'm always striving for, is this simplicity.
Right.
There's has to be an element that, you know, you can feel, and there also has to be an end. That's one thing we haven't talked about, is within every cue, there's always an emotional point that you're aiming for. It might uh-huh. happen at the beginning and then the rest of it's a fallout away from it, or it's a build up and you've got to pick that moment that the music is aiming for. You know how music's always looking for a point to hit, isn't it?
Right, right.
Even if it's Earth, Wind and Fire or something, there's a thing that's, I'm constantly looking for that moment. Okay, so where am I going to hit this? What's the most important part? Is it when she looks at him, or, you know, or is it when she looks away, or, you know, that it's that kind of thing. And so I'm constantly designing the music to hit those points. And the simpler the sound world, the much easier it is to do that. And using just analog gear and not using any sample libraries. When I'm using samples, obviously they're incredibly important because you know, in Downton, I had to mock up every cue,
right,
using sample libraries. But then it all got replaced, you know, by real instruments. And you kind of constantly got to remind yourself when you're writing it that actually, oh, don't worry, this sounds a bit crap at the moment, but actually, you know, once the real instruments play it, it'll be fine. Whereas doing this film, because I was building it up and it was going to be the sound of where it wasn't going to change, you know, it was quite interesting. I could tell, I knew it was going to work.
Yeah, that has to be liberating, not only to kind of step outside of that mock-up workflow, but I imagine stepping outside of so many aspects of the traditional workflow, you know, sort of making MIDIs, writing up the scores, where it sounds like an electricity, you were able to almost kind of narrow the gap in your compositional process and the final recording. You're sort of composing through the recording.
Yeah, I mean, there was no final recording, you know, everything, and it had to be sort of built up. So there was no actual final recording session.
Were there any specific musical influences, either from the world of film or, I guess, more particularly in that score, outside of the world of film? You talked about how you're really left to your own devices. You're a big fan of electronic music. Are there any artists or musicians from that world who have had a big impact on you as a composer?
Yeah, you know, I'm a big fan of Aphex Twin and Radiohead. In fact, I think with electricity, I think they temped, when they were editing it, I think they used quite a bit of Radiohead to temp with it. But it wasn't quite right in that the feeling of the sound world was good, but the songs kind of got in the way of the film when you were watching it and it became a song.
Right.
Drama just kind of stopped.
Sure.
But their use of those things when they were temping it was really handy for me. I could see what they were after. I mean, I love Aphex Twin just to listen to. I'm not quite sure how you'd use that kind of music in a film. Right. Although people have done.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely invigorating and inspiring music. There's just so much energy in Aphex Twin. And that's really interesting, thinking of Radiohead songs as it relates to a lot of your compositional voice. Not something I'd really considered, but I mean, in so many of our favorite Radiohead moments, there's these sort of innovative, almost kind of disturbed textures and often very pure, beautiful, direct melodies and harmony.
Yeah.
There. It's
yeah, I'm a big fan.
I mean, I think both with, say, Tom York or Johnny Greenwood and with yourself, I think there are these wonderful examples of how to sort of be true to maybe our kind of contemporary aesthetic, but really communicate something with emotional depth and something that's memorable. You know, whether it's electricity or whether it's Downton or Grantchester, there's definitely that thread throughout all of your work, I think, of very pure, inspired, you know, melody.
Thanks.
Sure.
Well, I'm just curious, what are some of your favorite film and television scores? You talked a little bit about the Experiencing Sound of Music and Chinatown. Are there any other, particularly in the world of television, that you respect?
Oh, well, that's a tricky one. Twin Peaks was it made a major splash over here.
Here as well, yeah.
Right.
That's right. In fact, Twin Peaks started here round about the time when up until that point, I'd been doing quite a few different sort of bands and I'd been working with dance companies. I think I was 32 and my first child had been born, and I suddenly had realized, oh my God, I'm going to have to make some money. and I do remember being, you know, thinking, God, that's so simple. It's so simple, but it's so effective. You know, and I remember thinking that to myself, you've got to keep that. That's, you know, in fact, it's a prime example, isn't it, of something. I mean, I think there's only like two tunes.
Right,
right.
Yeah, very, very minimal.
I mean, it's so long since I've heard it. You know, it just had that, you know, incredible feeling. It was just so perfect.
There's a lovely little video with, I think it was shot more recently, where Angelo Badalamenti is talking about developing the theme. He seems like such a sweet person.
My daughter played it to me. Yeah, no, that was fab. But he was sitting there going, oh yeah, no, why don't you do, what about that? Why don't you do that? You know, and it was right. It was really beautiful, yeah. What else, you know, in terms of TV? Well, it's funny enough, you know, ever since that, you know, of course, I've become, you know, incredibly competitive, and, you know, because I've been part of the world myself, you know, and,
sure.
And, you know, you, it's funny, you become, instead of appreciating it, you become, you know, a highly, you know, antagonistic, because it may be better than something you've done. It's funny, you get into that, you know. I love House of Cards. You know, I've met Jeff many times now.
Very effective title, that one.
Very, you know, in fact, I remember when I think when I won my first Emmy, I think I was up against Jeff, and I was convinced that he was going to win, but anyway, I won. I think he won the following year, you know. I think House of Cards is very, I think the music for Breaking Bad is really good.
Dave Porter, right?
Dave Porter, I thought it was really great, because it's such a difficult thing to do, that one, because it's got to have an impact. But, you know, what kind of music do you do for that right. thing? You know, and what he's so clever about the way he's done it is it's kind of, it's a bit like music from kind of outside, from another world. You know, it doesn't right. really explain what's going on in the scene, which is what I love. It does that great thing of doing something else which is not on the screen.
It's always fascinating to think about the power of television and film music and kind of enhancing what's not there and what's not in the scene. Thinking a little bit sort of back to the Downton world and kind of almost maybe the opposite end of that sort of equation. You know, most media composers are operating strictly within the post-production schedule and rarely, if ever, interact with the shooting crew and the cast. Now, this wasn't really the case with Downton, where you actually played a role throughout the series, providing musical accompaniment, arranging, and from what I understand, even teaching songs to some of the cast. What are some of your fonder memories of actually being a part of Downton on the set, and did that inform any of your feelings about scoring the show, having sort of been on the other side of it?
Yeah, it's true. I'm very rarely on the set, and usually, you know, if I turn up to a cast and crew screening of something, I feel like I know the actors incredibly well, because I've been watching them over and over again, you know, and I turn up and they all go, who the hell is this guy? You know, I have no idea, you know, who I am. With the case of Downton, I can't really remember how it happened. I think the producers got into a bit of a panic about, you know, some of the music on set, and I think they must have, you know, asked me for some advice about how they could do it. And I think probably in the end I said, well, I may as well come in, you know, I'll do it. Because I'm quite a good piano player. I play all the piano on Downton.
Oh, wow.
And so I think I got involved. I didn't get that involved in series one, but I definitely done in series two and three and four. And then towards series five and six, I got involved less, partly just because of time and schedule. You know, I got an assistant to kind of take over. But yeah, no, I quite enjoyed actually going on set, although I can tell you, it can be really boring. You know, you can be sitting there for hours. Seemingly nothing has happened, you know, sure. at all. I don't know how the actors go through it. I think probably the most famous one was with Shirley MacLaine, where they'd asked her to be Cora's mother.
Right.
They thought it was a good idea for her to sing a song in the show. They asked me to choose something. I ran it past her. She seemed quite happy, and so they asked me to go out on set and, you know, and rehearse with her. And in fact, I'm actually in the scene playing the piano.
Oh, terrific.
Although, actually, you don't see me.
But you're there, just behind Shirley.
And I'm in costume, and I had to have a wig on. I had a moustache. In fact, I looked like Liberace. See, I'm not in it. The producer took great delight in telling me that I didn't make the final cut. Let me So I had to work with Shirley. He was fantastic. Although it became quite obvious quite early on that rehearsing on set while it was filming going on was never going to work. And so she was staying in a hotel locally, and they put me up in the same hotel she was. And she would film during the day, and then she'd come back to the hotel, and they set up a piano in our room for us, and then, you know, we'd have a couple of dry martinis and loosen up a bit, and then, you know, and then rehearse for an hour. We did that a couple of nights in a row.
Wow, that's
got to be a great memory.
That's such a dream. Yeah, the apartment has to be one of our favorite films, and so love Shirley.
I know. I mean, it's funny to. In fact, I watched it quite recently. I couldn't kind of, you know. It was
timeless, that movie.
Take in with that, you know, spent several evenings talking to her.
Wow. No, that is terrific. And how wonderful that you're able to sort of leave your musical mark inside the show and sort of outside the show. That's, as far as I'm aware, a pretty unique opportunity in television.
Yeah, it's true. I don't think most composers kind of get involved in the, you know, in the stuff that has to be on set. I mean, it varies with me. You know, I sometimes get involved with it. Sometimes, you know, I'd rather steer clear of it. You know, sure. I mean, I've just done this other thing called Jamestown, which is about early English settlers in Virginia in the early 17th century. And I've gotten, you know, I've got involved in writing this. There's quite a lot of singing, people just, you know, singing song kind of old style. And the records of what those songs were, it's not, there are records of it, but they're not records, but there's
maybe old songbooks or something.
Yeah, there's some songbooks. But so I've kind of got involved in sort of rewriting those, you know, kind of for, you know, slightly more modern audience.
Oh, wow.
That's quite an interesting show. That was a difficult one to crack because it's set in America, but it's got English people and Scots and Irish. It's got American Indians.
Sure.
But it's not a Western, you know, but neither is it a kind of like a period drama either. I mean, it was quite tricky. So I've learned to play this thing called the Appalachian Mountain Dulcimer.
Oh, wow.
Right.
It's a kind of like it's like a drone instrument, except you lay it on your lap and you use like a dowel of wood to move up and down the frets. That was quite interesting.
And you're actually playing that on the score.
Yeah, I learned to play it. Yeah. But it was the only way, you know. I had to find something that again, that simple sound.
Sure.
You know, that defines the sound world, the whole thing, you know, and that was it.
I love what you said earlier about your job not being to reinforce the period of a piece. And I feel like with all of your scores, and particularly with Downton, it's really though you're sort of musically painting the period, not by using those historical devices, but the actual contour of the melody and the harmony that you're using actually sort of speaks to what those characters are going through and what that experience is like. And it sounds like there have now been several projects where you have to kind of navigate period in some form or another. How would you say you sort of generally approach period, given that you don't really see your job as to kind of pastiche or sort of send up an era?
Well, I mean, the Jamestown, the American one, was, you know, quite tricky because it's not a Western, you know. Americana is not even defined, you know, in any meaningful sense of the word yet. You know, it's kind of this, you know, sort of almost Celtic kind of, you know, combination of English, Irish, and Scots. The music at that time there was obviously, you know, some kind of folk music going on, and then there was this kind of whole, you know, religious music, which really was not appropriate whatsoever.
Sure.
You know, I mean, so, you know, I think I can't really ignore the period, but I don't think it's my job to make it sound as if we are in the period, because that's just not going to work. I mean, actually, an even better example of that is this thing I've done called The Last Kingdom, which is about Vikings. And this is set in the 9th century in Britain. And that's virtually all electronic, the music for that. It's virtually all. And I've met this amazing singer from the Faroe Isles called Ivor. E-I-V-O-R. And in fact, the two of us do the music together. We share credit for it. She's utterly amazing. So it's basically her, me doing a whole lot of electronic, you know, modular synthesis stuff. I mean, you know, not a million miles away from what those guys are doing on Stranger Things.
Sure.
You know, less 70s harmony, much starker. Mm-hmm. In fact, in some ways, closer to Aphex Twin, actually. And then I'm also playing double bass through heavily distorted through a guitar amp. And then it's quite a lot of percussion. And that's it. That makes up the whole sound world of 9th century, you know, England. Because, of course, nobody... I taught myself to play the lyre, which is like a six-string right. sort of harp thing as well. That's the only thing that was kind of the period. But by combining it, you know, that something that did exist in those days with, you know, an Oberheim 4 voice and then a singer from the Faroe Isles, you know, it just that combination, you know, kind
of felt right.
Yeah, it just felt right. Yeah.
Well, and like you say, it really elevates beyond what's actually there in the footage, and it's kind of amazing. Yeah. Sounds like another example where you're sort of musically painting some, you know, tapestry that's very appropriate and tonally on point for that show, but you're providing something that isn't there.
Yeah.
Well, one of the last things that I want to ask you, I've heard, you know, murmurings about a possible Downton film that may or may not be in the works. Do you have any information about that? And what I'm most curious about is, will you be returning to do the music for such a project?
If it happens, I will be returning to do the music for it. Yeah. And I'm fairly sure it's going to happen, but I can't say for certain.
Sure.
I think there's quite a lot of things have to fall into alignment, you know, for example. I'm pretty confident. I think most people, you know, want to do it. Yeah.
There's certainly the audience for it, that's for sure.
There's certainly the audience for it. It's more about a question about getting the actors together,
right?
You know, and getting the scripts.
And so many of your actors now have become really stars in their own right. I mean, two of them, I think, are now Disney Prince and a Disney Princess among them.
Exactly. You know, I mean, so, you know, I think there are all those things. I think everybody wants to do it. And yeah, I've been asked if I would do it. I think Julian Fellowes was on record himself as saying that, you know, if we are going to do a film about Downton, we've got to make it. It's got to be Downton, you know, and it's, you know, there's no point in trying to pretend that it's going to be, you know, something else just because it's a film.
Right.
Right.
So it's got to be Downton, you know, in a 90-minute format.
That's lovely to hear. I think a few of us were somewhat disappointed when the Simpsons film ultimately came out and Alf Clausen, who has scored that show from the beginning, was not called, and it was Mr. Hans Zimmer that composed that score,
what's that all about? I mean, you never know. I mean, of course, some of those decisions are commercial.
Sure.
Right. You
know, he does have brand recognition. And that's
brand recognition.
But to that extent, why not even Danny Elfman, whose theme is...
The actual theme in itself. Yeah, I know. But, you know, but also, why do you want to have a different take on it, you know, with the music? I don't think people want to turn up and see, you know, Hans Zimmer's version of Downton Abbey music, do they?
Right.
I certainly don't.
I mean, not that he would want to do it anyway, but I mean, it seemed pointless, I think.
Right.
We shall see. Anyway, I know I've been asked to do it, but, you know, no contract. So.
Well, thinking about your most recent score, at least most recent television show, since it's still on air right now, The White Princess, can we expect a soundtrack release?
Good question. We are talking about it. You know, unfortunately, the timing is just because, I mean, we literally, you know, I finished it, what, like 3 weeks ago, the actual series itself. And it's on, in fact, I think less. So I've had so little time, you know, to even think about, you know, about doing, you know, a soundtrack of it. And then, of course, the series will probably be finished in about another 5 weeks. You know, we wouldn't be able to get it out in time for the series still being on. So, you know, it's difficult to know. I think there is a desire there for it, because, of course, once it goes on Stars, it'll be sold all over the world, and, you know, I suspect we probably will, yeah.
Oh, well, that would be terrific.
I know, because I'm sitting here and I haven't done anything about it.
Well, you're on a well-deserved break, it sounds like, John. It sounds like it's been a very busy year. And I mean, you've been a busy man in this industry for over 25 years now, has it been?
Yeah.
Well, where can our listeners find out more about John Lunn?
Well, I've got a website, which is jlunn.com, which you go, and on there I've got there are links to, you know, SoundCloud. You know, I've put a lot of my music on there. I think, you know, that's probably a good place to start.
And I know several of your soundtracks are on the iTunes store and in Spotify and wherever digital music is sold.
Yeah, they're all. I mean, there's a lot on YouTube, but there was a lot of, you know, things I did, you know, 10 or 12 years ago that didn't come out in soundtrack. There was some kind of contractual problem with the BBC about positions, but you went through a period of, I did some great things like Bleak House and Lorna Doone.
Sure.
Little Dorrit. We've never been able to make a soundtrack of those because of some contractual dispute between the musicians and the BBC. There's a whole load of stuff that I did in that period. And it wasn't just me. I mean, there's quite a few of us that have suffered from that. We've never been able to sort of release those soundtracks, which is very frustrating. But a lot of them kind of have, you know, kind of managed to find their way onto YouTube.
Sure. I suppose it's good for the music to live on in some form. I mean, we'd like everyone to be properly compensated, but what can you do?
Yeah, well, you know, there isn't really any money in soundtrack albums anyway, so it's not as if, so they are kind of vanity projects anyway, but it's a good thing to do, I think. And it's a good thing, you know, it's also good publicity for the show itself as well.
Right.
You know, those things, you know. You know, I mean, Downton's done, actually, Downton, the soundtrack for Downton has done really well. But most of them don't do much.
Yeah, you bring up a good point. You know, a really effective score can further act as marketing for a project. I know Will and I sometimes were sort of baffled at how sort of minimal and perhaps safe a lot of contemporary scores are. And just from that perspective that, oh, well, they're even missing out on a great marketing opportunity, if nothing else. It does seem surprising that there's maybe a little bit more restraint than would seem natural, given the talented composers that are working. And we're just so thrilled that so much of, you know, your music is out there and that you're working on so many wonderful projects. Because for our money, it's really that incredible balance of contemporary 21st century musical idiom, but it just with such memorable, heartfelt tunes. And that's an incredibly rare bird these days, I think, John.
It's true. Maybe we should all get together and talk about why that is, because, you know, obviously, you know, I'm not, you know, with those other people and those other shows, you know, I'm not sitting in on, you know, the talking to the executives about what it is they want the music to be doing, you know, for the show. So I'm not really party to that. But I think every conversation I've had with whatever I've worked on, there's people are, you know, kind of looking for the music to give the show some kind of identity and some, you know, something memorable, you know, about it, you know, and the theme tunes, you know, is a massive part of it. It's that, you know, oh my God, you know, Downton, you can sit in the kitchen boiling your kettle to make your tea, right. And so Downton comes on, you go, oh my God, it's Downton Abbey. You know, I mean, that's a very rather some sort of simplistic view of it, but that does work, you know, it's now synonymous with a brand. I mean, you know, as soon as you think of Downton Abbey, you know, you think of that theme.
John, we've taken so much of your time this evening, and we want to be mindful of that, and of course the time difference.
Thank you so much for giving us an insight on your wonderful career. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks, boys.
Oh, no, it was our pleasure. And yeah, you take care, John.
Take care.
You as well.
Thanks so much for listening to today's episode.
Once again, we invite you to send any questions, concerns, or thoughts about the show to our email address, the_show@gmail.com. You can find every single episode of this podcast, as well as some of our neat supplemental materials, at our website, underscorepodcast.com. And you can follow us on all matters of social media, Facebook, YouTube.
If you're enjoying the show, please feel free to subscribe and leave us a review at iTunes. That helps new listeners discover the podcast.
And as always, you can follow us on Twitter @_show.
The second underscore is silent.
Until next time, everybody.
And remember, we listen because we love. Take care. Underscore is part of the Mercado Brothers Podcast Network.